With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I am proud to announce that Food Pharmacy, one of the biggest health brands in Sweden, is now launching its highly acclaimed blog, as well as books and podcasts in English. Food Pharmacy is eager to take its award-winning Scandinavian concept and share it with the rest of the world, and to contribute to the fight against the global burden of lifestyle-related diseases. In 2014, Lina Nertby and Mia Klasa started Food Pharmacy, embarking on a long, sometimes meandering, often magical journey towards their goal of improving public health. Along the way, they've spoken with a variety of experts and professionals in various fields related to health and lifestyle. In this podcast series, you'll meet a few of them. Be a part of the journey. This is the Food Pharmacy Show.
Lina, and welcome back to the Food Pharmacy Show. You are Lina and I am Mia.
Yes, we are.
What's on your mind today, Lina?
I actually think about cancer.
Oh, cancer.
What do you think about when I say the word cancer?
Wow, there are so many things that come to me immediately when I hear that word. I feel fear, of course. I feel sadness, powerlessness, but I also feel anger. And another word that pops up is mother. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was only 43 years old. I was a teenager at that time, and I was so angry and scared, of course. Luckily, since I was so young, she won the battle. But 25 years later, she was diagnosed again. And this time, she didn't make it. And she passed away in just 3 months. But I mean, it's not just my mother. You lost a few family members as well.
Yes, and cancer is actually the disease I myself have been afraid of all my life.
Same here.
And cancer is, in a way, also the initial reason we started Food Pharmacy, isn't it?
Mm.
Because 6 years ago, when your mom, my aunt, and our best friend's mom all died of cancer within a year, and all of them were way too young.
Way too young. They were just around 60 years old.
Yeah, and then we ran into a professor, and he taught us that lifestyle has a far greater impact on our health than we had ever imagined. Actually, he told us many things, but what really mattered to us at that point was that we have a lot to gain on lifestyle changes.
Yeah, and this is actually where our journey started.
Yes, it is. And the good thing is that the lifestyle and food that can prevent cancer is the same lifestyle and food that can prevent all the biggest lifestyle-related diseases today.
Mm-hmm.
Heart disease, diabetes type 2, but also obesity, yeah?
Yeah, and this is very important to remember. Obesity increases the risk of cancer. And when it comes to children, those who are overweight or obese have an increased risk of getting a serious disease later in life.
Sorry for interrupting you here, because this is very important. We read just the other day that 1 out of 3 9-year-old today are overweight or obese. 1 out of 3.
This is also why the Swedish Cancer Society wants the Swedish government to impose a tax on sugary drinks.
Yes, And cancer is increasing rapidly over the world.
It is.
And it's one of the most common causes of death. But one good news.
Love good news.
Yeah. And that is, cancer survival has more than doubled since the 50s. And this is thanks to the advances in research. 2 out of 3 people diagnosed with cancer now survive. So we have come a long way.
We have.
But we're not there yet.
No, we're not. But apart from early detection, diagnosis and treatment, you have a lot to gain from preventive health.
Yes, indeed. According to the World Health Organization, prevention offers the most cost-effective long-term strategy for the control of cancer.
Perfect, I would say. But what is cancer prevention?
Cancer prevention is action taken to lower the risk of getting cancer. And this can include maintaining a healthy lifestyle, avoiding exposure to known cancer-causing substances, and taking, for example, vaccines that can prevent cancer from developing. According to the Swedish Cancer Society, 30% of all cancer could be prevented with lifestyle changes.
We repeat, 30% could be prevented.
And today we meet with Professor Robert Thomas.
Love Robert Thomas.
He's a cancer specialist with 30 years experience in patient care. He has been named Doctor of the Year by Hospital Doctor magazine and Oncologist of the Year by British Oncology Association. He has a particularly strong research interest on how lifestyle interacts with the cancer process and how an optimal lifestyle can improve quality of life and disease outcome following a diagnosis of cancer. And Professor Thomas leads a government research department in England that studies the importance of lifestyle in cancer care.
And as a clinical tutor at Cambridge University, he teaches medical students in clinic and at the bedside.
Yeah, and he scored the highest grade outstanding clinical teacher from every student for 3 years running.
So, are we ready?
We are so honored to welcome Professor Thomas to the Food Pharmacy Show. For being a doctor, you are unique for integrating nutritional and lifestyle strategies into cancer treatment. And I am so curious to know where this passion comes from.
My passion to try to empower patients to help themselves probably started about 20 years ago when I became a consultant, which was really busy. And it was very hard to spend time to explain things to patients. So we thought, well, let's develop strategies so they can go away and learn for themselves. And that originally started off as just information materials. And then we realized that a lot of the information wasn't backed with science. So from that, we developed a research laboratory to try and find out what things patients should do so we can then tell them. So and then more and more, we got more interested in the field, because at the end of the day, it is an interesting field. We all want to know what we should do in life to better our chances.
Yeah, for longevity.
Mm.
So let's start from the beginning. We can't change our genes. However, we can change the way they behave.
Correct. Some people are born with very robust genes, and we've all met these relatives who smoke and drink all their life and were overweight and still live till 90.
Mm.
They're the lucky ones. And yet, on the other side of the coin, we have people who are born with very fragile genes, so they're very prone to get cancer or other degenerative conditions. And those people, you know, sometimes live the life of an angel and still get cancer at a young age. But the vast majority of us are in between, and we do have a very strong influence on how our genes express and how the expression of those genes determines whether we get a chronic illness, including cancer.
Mm. So I read in your book that a common question put by someone who has been diagnosed with cancer is, why me? But maybe we should rather ask ourselves, why not me? Since we have thousands of potential cancers already programmed in our DNA.
Mm.
I didn't know this.
Yes, I mean, many patients find it surprising. They think you've caught cancer somehow, but we're born with cancers locked in our DNA. And it takes a break of the DNA, so a genetic damage, which could be spontaneous, or it could be the food you've eaten, or the lifestyle you've chosen to live, not exercising, etc. And when those genes then become expressed, the cells become abnormal, and there's a whole cascade of things which happen before that cell becomes a full-blown cancer. It has to go through various processes like oxidative repair, DNA repair. Even the immunity can mop up many cells. So it's been estimated that probably about 5,000 cells potentially become cancerous every day, and our normal defenses stop them happening. So
every day?
Every day, yes. So so that's why I say, you know, it's we should say, why haven't we got cancer? Mm. I mean, the body is amazing that it is able to protect itself from cancers. But unfortunately, in over a lifetime, one in two of us will get cancer. Mm. So it is increasing, and it is now a common disease.
Mm. A few weeks ago, it was the World Cancer Day. And I read that the World Cancer Organization, they urge for doctors and organizations to spread the word that knowledge about our lifestyle and food could prevent millions of cancer diagnoses, and also a lot of people dying from cancer. So approximately one third of all cancer could be prevented only by choosing the right kind of food.
Yes, I mean, the latest figures from the WHO and the World Cancer Research Fund is that half cancers actually are determined by lifestyle. So it'd be up to 50%.
Mm.
Of course, if you talk about how many would die of cancer, I mean, many of those people would be fortunately cured, but have to go through the trauma of cancer treatments. You know, there's lots of statistics we can quote. For example, if you eat processed meat, there's a more than three times a week, you have an 18% chance of dying of bowel cancer. So even just reducing your meat intake will reduce the risk of dying of bowel cancer by about 20%. Mm. So yes, there's lots we can do. And obviously in the book, I've gone through the various different things. You know, the obvious ones are not smoking, don't get sunburn, eat lots of...
And sorry for interrupting. I also learned that don't smoke in the sun, talking
Absolutely.
About these two, because then your risk even get bigger.
Yes, and many people don't talk about the interaction between different carcinogens. But of course, we have one strip of DNA being attacked. And if you attack it with one thing, such as smoking, that's bad enough. But if you attack it with three or four different things at the same time, so if you're in the sun and you're lazing around, you have poor gut health, you're smoking, you're hitting that DNA with multiple different attacks. On the other side of the coin, reassuringly, if, for example, you have a nice glass of red wine and you don't smoke and you don't sunburn, and you put olive oil on your skin after you've been in the sun, those are all protective. So you might have a little bit of sunburn, which is not good, but you could mitigate the risks very significantly by a healthy diet, a glass of wine, and improving your gut health.
Mm. Talking about gut health, you're at the right place.
Good.
And we've been writing books about gut health. Mm. But what importance would you say that the gut is for a healthy life?
Well, I've always been keen on promoting gut health for 20 years, but I'm really pleased to see that the medical profession, particularly oncology, has now woken up to this. And there's various conspiratory theories why this happened. We know that if you have a poor gut health, you're more likely to respond badly to cancer treatments. You're more likely to get side effects from chemotherapy, side effects from radiotherapy. More recently, oncology's moved over to biological treatments. These are called immunotherapies. And like, for example, 10 years ago, I would say 80% of my patients are on chemotherapy. I would say it's now down to about 15%. The rest are on these biological treatments, which the scientific community has done really well to develop. They're amazing new drugs. And what they tend to do is they uncloak a cancer cell so that your own immunity can recognize it and kill it. And let's face it, the immunity kills thousands of cells a day anyway. But when a cancer's formed a mass, it's harder for it. So, and it would have developed mechanisms to hide from the immunity. So, in other words, all these drugs are doing is telling yourself to kill the cancer. Now, if yourself is in a poor condition, in other words, you have poor gut health, or you have a bad diet, and you have lots of other carcinogens, you are not able to interact with these drugs and kill your cancer. Now, that's not just my opinion. There are now reports coming out from institutes like Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York or MD Anderson showing that there is a 40% improved response rate from these new biologicals if you have improved gut health.
That is really high.
Exactly. And these are, well, that's great for us, humanity. It's also great for the drug companies, because if you think about it, these drugs are over £100,000 or €150,000 a year. So if they're getting a 40% increased response rate, their share price is going to go through the roof. So suddenly they're promoting in conferences. Maybe 10 years ago, I was talking about gut health and behind the pillar with two people in the audience. You talk about gut health now and there's a packed audience all trying to find out how we can improve the gut health of our patients. To such an extent, we're now thinking about prehabilitation programs. So before giving these drugs, they go off to, they go to listen to your podcast and they look at your book and they eat those foods to improve the gut health, and then they have the treatments, which is more likely to respond and get less toxicity.
That's wonderful, because in that way you could combine. I mean, you often when I read about pharma, big pharma and food, it felt like they've been far away from each other, but this is actually a way where you can see the benefit from one and another.
Absolutely.
That's really good. So many people have a belief that a person who suffers from cancer should put all the effort to focus on treatment and live just as normal. I read that you said nothing could be more wrong.
Well, we've just talked about gut health. So if my advice for anyone just diagnosed with cancer is try to improve your gut health as much as possible. On top of that, we know from lots of data now, this is established data, that if you exercise 3 hours a week, at least after most cancers, particularly breast, bowel, and prostate, you have a better chance of responding to treatments. You're less likely to get toxicities such as fatigue, weight gain, diabetes, heart attacks, but you have a 30 to 40% reduced chance of your cancer relapsing after initial treatments. The same applies to what we call polyphenol-rich foods. Now, these are natural chemicals in food which give it its color, its taste, and its smell. And I've just looked at your book, and basically every ingredient is polyphenol rich. And these foods have enormous benefits. They promote gut health because they act as prebiotics to feed the healthy bacteria. They reduce inflammation and improve immunity, as well as lots of other benefits. So, and it's known that that if you eat these foods after cancer, you also have a 30 to 40% reduction in the risk of cancer coming back. So there's several things you can do which will significantly improve your outcomes.
So you're talking about food rich in polyphenols and antioxidants. Would you recommend the same food if someone wants to prevent getting cancer in the first way? Is it the same food you would recommend?
Yes, pretty much so. That healthy food is healthy food at any part of the pathway. So it's preventing cancer, it's improving your tolerance to treatments, and it's reducing the risk of cancer coming back. And it mustn't be forgotten that many of the toxicity of cancer treatments are things people get every day anyway, such as diabetes, heart attack, stroke, cognitive disorders, dementia. And these are more common after cancer treatment. So it's even more important to concentrate on your health to avoid other illnesses.
You said exercise 3 times a week. You can exercise in different ways. Do you mean go into the gym or go out running, or what could you choose? Or
yes, I mean, one of my side hobbies is to lead the UK Expert Advisory Committee on Exercise and Cancer. So we have these discussions. We've had these discussions for 10 years. What is exercise? How much is needed? And there's different levels of benefit. So if you get off the couch, if you just walk around, you will reduce the risk of getting blood clots, which is a significant toxicity of treatment. So even doing a little bit of exercise will give you a big benefit. To have the anti-cancer properties of exercise kicking in, you really have to work a little bit harder. Because when you start getting breathless and hot, you it's about 180 chemicals are formed in your bloodstream, most of which have anti-cancer properties. And they only really start kicking in when you start working at exercise. So ambling around the park looking at the roses may be slightly beneficial, but going for a run or getting hot and sweaty or anything you enjoy, so an exercise class, being on a treadmill, playing a competitive sport. Like in Britain, walking football is very popular.
Walking football?
Yeah, I suppose it's a competitive, not quite so strenuous exercise for elderly men and women. But it's things which you enjoy and is sustainable. So there's no point putting someone in a gym if they don't enjoy it. But if they enjoy walking football or they enjoy rowing, and part of the role we're doing now, certainly in the cancer unit I work, is to try to interview patients and work with them to see what they are likely to enjoy and adopt behavioural change interviewing to encourage them to continue with that exercise for the rest of their life.
Then it's more, if you enjoy something, it's more likely you stick to it than if it's something you dislike.
Yeah.
Of course.
And to be honest, with the coronavirus outbreak, I'm not encouraging patients to go and exercising in gyms at the moment.
No.
Get some fresh air, go outside.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So you have actually collected the most interesting scientific studies on natural health and cancer, and you have put them together in a book called Keep Healthy After Cancer. And I read this book, I strongly recommend it to anyone who want to know more about the studies out there. And I mean, in general, we will go down into specific foods, but in general, what would you say we should have more of, and what should we avoid?
That's a very long question. We could talk for 3 hours on that. I mean, the reason why I actually wrote the book is we've written over 100 medical publications in scientific journals, which are read by doctors, which is fine, but a lot of that doesn't dissipate down to patients where it's needed. So I summarize the salient points of the medical trials and put it into a lay book. So it's quite scientific at times, but I think people want to know, you know, exactly why they should change their life. And if it's explained to them, they're more likely to sustain the change. But so it's split up into, first of all, the fundamentals of what is cancer, why it's formed, what goes wrong in our bodies when it's formed, why some people are more vulnerable than others. And then there's a large section on things which are likely to increase your risk of cancer. And, you know, the obvious are is smoking, sunburning, not being in the sun. Being in the sun, as you know, coming from Scandinavia, is healthy because it puts your vitamin D levels up. And that brings us to having low vitamin D is not good. It increases the risk of cancer and other degenerative diseases. And then the carcinogens. And carcinogens can either be damaging because they promote inflammation, or they can be directly damaging to DNA. And fundamentally, cancer's in our DNA. So if you damage DNA, you're increasing the risk of cancer. And then it goes through all the different common carcinogens in our environment. So, you know, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are in burnt meat, nitrous amines, which is in meat, which you eat without having vegetables with it, for example. And then you've got the
acrylamide. Acrylamide.
Yes, exactly. Acrylamides. Well, acrylamides is, I've got to be careful about acrylamides in Sweden, because there's quite a lot of acrylamides in rye bread and crackers, which you eat a lot of. And I was criticized for that. And the evidence isn't that strong, actually. So it's not as strong as, say, aromatic hydrocarbons in meat. But yes, there is some thought. If you have sugary foods which are baked to high temperature, or even carbohydrate-rich foods baked to high temperatures, they generate acrylamides.
Like a muffin, for example.
Yeah, so anything, crisps, for example, Pringles, without, I don't want to mention a brand, but they're particularly bad because they're processed carbohydrate with added sugar baked at a very high temperature. So that's a perfect storm for increasing your acrylamide content.
So that is what we should avoid, if something.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a buffet and you see, you know, crackers, burnt bread or bread which is burnt, you know, black toast, for example, crisps, Pringles. That's steer clear if you can.
I will. And when it comes to food that we should have more of, you say that having vegetables to every meal, fruit and vegetables, could actually help a lot.
So it's very important when you consider a meal, which even with the best will in the world will have some bad things and some good things, but obviously it's the balance to good things. So for example, if you eat meat, you will have nitrates included, and those nitrates are metabolized into nitroso compounds. Now, nitroso compounds are very carcinogenic. However, if you eat meat with lots of fruit and vegetables, particularly vegetables, they contain polyphenols and vitamin C, which actually converts the nitrate into nitric oxide, which is actually healthy. It causes peripheral dilation of blood vessels, so it lowers your blood pressure. And it's supposed to improve brain function and sports performance and many things. That's why people eat nitrate-rich foods to improve sports performance, for example. So it's so on the other hand, if you have a big plate of meat and you eat it with, say, chips or
a burger
fries or a burger,
bread
with no natural antidote, you're just getting all the negative part. So it's about combining foods is the most important. But I would, as a general rule, every meal should have something colourful, fresh, preferably raw, where the polyphenols and the phytochemicals which protect us are there in greater quantities.
Because you lift specifically antioxidants. Could you just explain why the antioxidants in fruit and vegetables are so healthy to us?
Well, we've actually stopped using the term antioxidants. It's because it was overused in the past. phytochemicals and polyphenols in foods have an antioxidant property, but they're not direct antioxidants. They only enhance the antioxidant pathway. Now, antioxidant system refers to a thing called oxidative stress. Now, this occurs within the nucleus of a cell. So if we have too many damaging chemicals called free radicals, and these are generated actually naturally within the cell when it creates energy, but it's but conditions which require more energy. So being overweight, having chronic inflammation in your body requires more energy production. So you get more free radicals. And if on the other side you have you don't have enough polyphenols, or you have a mineral deficiency, you have a deficiency in the production of antioxidant enzymes. Mm. Now, all polyphenols in fruit and veg do is they encourage the capacity of the antioxidant enzyme. So they make it more efficient. So if you then do something, you say go for a run, and you have lots of free radicals. If you're healthy, your antioxidant system upregulates and balances it. If you then eat direct antioxidants, which are actually vitamin A and vitamin E and some synthetic antioxidants, there is a danger you mop up too many free radicals and the balance between the oxidative and the antioxidative stress is impaired. We also know, because my other hat is actually a sports scientist in the local university, so we do a lot of experiments on people and sportsmen. Now, unlike polyphenols, which upregulate the antioxidant enzymes, the vitamin A and vitamin E blocks the upregulation of the antioxidant system. So you'll get a brief benefit from taking antioxidants, which are actually vitamin A and vitamin E. Mm. But in the longer term, in other words, hours after exercise, when they go out of your system, you haven't upregulated the natural enzymes. So it leads to worse oxidative stress. And that's why sportsmen now are told not to take vitamin A and vitamin E supplements, because it increases the risk of muscle damage, joint pains. Now, from a cancer perspective, it also increases the risk of cancer if you regularly take high doses of antioxidants. Mm. But the trouble is the general public don't understand that antioxidants only refers to chemicals which can directly mop up a free radical, in other words, vitamin A and vitamin E. Mm. Now, it's been known for 15 years that these trials which have been conducted with those vitamins had to be stopped because they increased the risk of cancer.
Wasn't it particularly lung cancer with vitamin E?
There was about five or six different studies. Oh. I mean, there was two on lung cancer. There was one on head and neck cancer. There's one more recently looking at a number of degenerative diseases, cancer and heart disease and diabetes, all of which were increased in a population who took vitamin A and vitamin E supplements. There was the SELECT study, which was looking at selenium and vitamin E. I don't think it was the selenium, I think it was the vitamin E, which showed an increased risk of prostate cancer at the end of it. So I'm not saying if you're deficient in those vitamins, it's good, but most of us aren't deficient. Mm. I mean, I do a nutritional test online and most people come back with pretty adequate vitamin A and vitamin E with a good diet. Mm. So I'm just talking about supplement, but it's very confusing for the public because the journalists will say antioxidants are bad, which is actually technically correct. But when the person reading it looks at it, they think antioxidants are things in fruit and veg, or supplements which don't have any antioxidants, direct antioxidants. So, and then some people say supplements are bad. Well, supplements could include vitamin D, which we know is very healthy to take. It could also include a vitamin which someone needs because they're deficient in it, like vitamin B12 or something. Mm. So as a consequence of that, sorry, it's a long answer, I avoid the term antioxidant because it's leading to confusion.
But if we talk about polyphenols, because that is what we get a lot from by eating fruit and vegetables, and also talking about supplements, your team is well known for a study I read about, POMIT. And this study is it's unique in a way because it's a big, quite big study, and it's on a supplement, and it's very hard to find finance for these kind of studies. So could you tell us about what you found in this? Because it was about polyphenols.
Yes, so we looked at asked our patients if they were taking supplements, and about 80% were. We then looked at what they were taking, and about half of them were taking things which might have even done harm, such as vitamin A or vitamin E supplements, or chemicals removed. So any supplement which contains a chemical which is removed from food and concentrated has not been shown to be beneficial. So we then formed a government committee, actually. We formed a scientific group and said, well, let's have a look at different foods and see which ones are most likely to have an anti-cancer effect. And we came down, I mean, lots are. I mean, in your cookbook, nearly every page has got foods which have anti-cancer effects. But within a study, we have to quantify it. So obviously, it's easier to put it into a whole food supplement. We're not saying you should take that instead of a good diet, but it's often a way to boost the intake of those foods, particularly, say, first thing in the morning and lunchtime. Because in the UK, for example, it's not common to start the day with polyphenol-rich foods such as turmeric, green tea, broccoli, pomegranates. So we determined the evidence from animal studies and from cell line studies and limited clinical studies, and those four foods seem to meet the best criteria. It's also important to combine food from different food sources. So there's no point in taking, say, ginger and turmeric because they're actually from the same family and they're the same, more or less the same polyphenols. So we wanted polyphenols from different groups. So you have a broad spectrum which attacks different parts of the cancer pathway. So that was the hypothesis, to see if we can boost the diet with a simple whole food supplement, which didn't have direct antioxidant properties. And therefore, we just conducted a trial called a double-blind randomized study where half the people took the supplement and half had a placebo, which is the most robust trial you can design. It was government funded and government audited, so that's also made it very different. So there was no commercial backing to it. And we were very pleased to see that after 6 months, there was a very significant difference in the rate of progression of prostate cancer. I didn't mention all these men had early prostate cancer in this trial. And then we presented that in ASCO, in the world's largest cancer conference. So there was no resistance from the medical profession, actually. This is a very much a drug conference, and we were invited to present as one of the 10 best studies for that year. So there was a lot of interest in it. We were very pleased about that. So I think the medical profession is open-minded about nutrition. The problem is, it's very rare that a nutritional study is evaluated in that strict, robust format. So they would believe the data. And then from then, we had to do a sub-study because people said it may have just affected the PSA. We did a study to show it did actually affect the underlying size of the tumour, so on MRI scans. So we were delighted for that. From then, although that was a non-commercial, it has gone on and it's now made all over the world, and people have a choice of taking it, which, as I say, works for some people if their diet isn't perfect, and others if they maybe just want an extra boost.
So talking about supplements, we talked about vitamin D before, and you mentioned that deficiency in vitamin D actually could increase the risk of getting cancer. And what would you say if you live in a country like this where you hardly see the sun 6 months a year? Is it advisable to take supplements of vitamin D, and why?
I would say yes, the answer to that. The data is confusing. It is very clear, and nobody would argue, that if you are vitamin D deficient, you have an increased risk of cancer, you have an increased risk of arthritis, heart disease, dementia, lots of chronic diseases. What is less clear, if you take a supplement, will you reduce your risk? there's been lots of studies done over the years, and most of them don't show a significant benefit. But I feel it's because they're not very well designed.
Mm.
For example, the last one from Canada didn't measure vitamin D levels at the start of the study, because it's clear that the people who are going to benefit most are the people with a low level from the start.
Mm.
And my view is that people probably didn't go into the study if they had low levels. They probably just took the supplement. So I don't think there's been a definitive trial yet to prove that. There was one in prostate cancer recently in men who were on active surveillance. So a bit like the POMI-T study, they were being watched, and they quite clearly showed that people who took supplements progressed at a slower rate. Mm. So I always tell my men who I see on active surveillance in the winter months to just routinely take a vitamin D supplement, between 1,000 and 2,000 international units a day,
mm.
from, you know, around about October to April.
Mm.
There's certainly no study to show it does any harm,
mm.
unlike vitamin A and vitamin E. So it won't do any harm. It's not expensive. If you can afford a winter holiday, you know, halfway through,
mm.
Vitamin D has a 6-week half-life. So if you can go to the Canary Islands halfway through the winter, that would also be beneficial.
Mm. So what you say is that when it comes to supplements, the best thing you could do actually is to test yourself to know what supplements do you need.
Yeah.
But to be very careful and don't take supplements of vitamin A and E if you're not deficient in it. Vitamin D, if you live in a country like this, could be beneficial. Talking about fat, you say that there is strong evidence that unhealthy fat and calorie excess adds to the risk of developing cancer.
Yeah, that's two sort of slightly different things. You can have calorie excess just from eating too much food. In fact, there was one study showed that if you eat too much healthy food, you're having too many calories.
Mm.
So, and that increases the glycemic index and glycemic load, and that creates inflammation. But there are some fats like trans fats, which aren't really used by the body for anything useful. And they are, they're just calories. So, you know, the things in chip fat and fat added to meats often, and previously margarines. I think people are using less and less margarines now, aren't they?
Mm.
They're just bad. You know, there's no benefit for them. Other fats, which you find omega-3, omega-6.
This is where I was going to about supplements on omega-3.
Yeah, they can be, they can be very helpful. We need them. I mean, the brain is 30% omega-6. So, you know, we need these fats for healthy living. But again, if you have too many of those, there's too many calories. And some people who are worried about weight gain need to reduce all fat intake. But for the rest of us, you know, fats are good because they are slow release energy. There's a lot of energy in fat, but it's slow release. So it doesn't increase the glycemic index. They're needed for various bodily functions like cell wall function. There is, just on this, I just want to state a myth between omega-3 and omega-6. It's commonly seen in cookbooks and other things that omega-6 is pro-inflammatory and omega-3 is anti-inflammatory, which is actually a complete myth. There's no truth in it at all.
Oh, tell us.
We need both fats.
Yeah, but in balance, isn't that so? They should be in balance.
Yes.
And isn't it so that we have extracted omega-3, or the food industry has extracted omega-3 from a lot of food because it's so sensitive. So the food is getting old quicker.
Oh, is it?
This is what I've read. But that this has created an imbalance between omega-3 and omega-6. So many people have more omega-6 in relation to omega-3.
Yes, it is. But you're entirely right. As I say, I do a nutritional profile where we measure all the different omega fats, and it's often the omega-3s which are low.
Mm.
It's still heard that the omega-6 promotes inflammation. It's not true. Omega-6 is in the pathway of inflammation, which means you need omega-6 for the inflammatory pathway, which of course we all need appropriate inflammation. But an efficient inflammatory process also needs omega-6 to stop inflammation when we don't need it. Omega-6.
Yeah, okay,
so omega-6. So it's one of the things I really... it's sort of a bit of a bugbear when I hear people saying you must reduce omega-6. No, if you want to balance, you need to increase your omega-3, but don't reduce your omega-6 foods, such as avocados full of omega-6. Lots of vegetable fats are omega-6. But you're right, we do need to increase our omega-3s. And that's hard because two studies showed taking omega-3 supplements increase the risk of prostate cancer, both from the same author in California. My take on that is, which is rather surprising, nobody mentioned that both supplements have vitamin E in, which has been proven to increase the risk of cancer. So they label omega-3 supplements as carcinogenic, but nobody saw the elephant in the room, that it was actually the antioxidant they added to it to stop it going off was vitamin E. So I would say it probably is safe to take an omega-3 supplement as long as it doesn't have a direct antioxidant added. Unfortunately, most do, because otherwise they'd go off. And omega-3 supplements, when they go off in a process called lipoperoxidase, that actually is carcinogenic. So you're stuck then. You know, what do you do? The only thing you can do is try to eat more seafood, fresh fish, and some foods like flax seeds and some chia seeds have omega-3. So you have to make a real effort to increase your omega-3s. And I've noticed in your cookbook, you have things like chia and fish. Is that right?
Mackerel.
Mackerel, yeah, things like that. But you have to, you know, certainly the British diet is very poor. You know, we're surrounded by sea. But, you know, if I ask my friends how many times they had mackerel a week, they would probably say once a month or once every 2 months. It needs to be every week, I'm afraid.
You mentioned before a few foodstuffs like broccoli, turmeric, pomegranate. And would you regard these as like natural superfoods?
Yeah, the word superfood really relates to foods which have got high levels of polyphenols and phytochemicals, which have health benefits, which apply to many foods, even common foods like apples and bananas and things. But some have more than others, and some have a certain type of polyphenol. So broccoli, for example, has indole-3-carbinol and sulforaphane, which are particularly good for, I think, a process called epigenetics. So they promote the genes which fight cancer. They reduce chronic inflammation. So those are the two, and they improve gut health because they act as prebiotics, and they've got fiber and vitamins and minerals in as well. So they're pretty super, you know, they are pretty good for you. And the same applies for turmeric, which has anti-inflammatory properties, tea. Pomegranate is got tannins. So all those foods, certainly they were the ingredients of pomi tea for the trial. That's why we picked them. But anything within that category is beneficial. And just to stress again, these are not direct antioxidants. They promote the antioxidant pathway and make it more efficient. And they reduce inflammation, improve gut health. They actually also slow the transfer of sugar across the gut wall. So if you have something sugary, but you've eaten it with these foods, you get a less effect of the sugar. It slows the glycemic index. So, you know, we could talk for, you know, 5 hours on the benefits of polyphenol-rich foods. They are amazing. They're a gift from nature to us.
So a dessert with turmeric latte and some pomegranate on top of it would be good.
Yes, if you like turmeric for a dessert, I think some people...
A turmeric latte, you know, you can drink it as a coffee.
Yes, yeah. I think in my blog I have got a recipe for that, but... Yeah. Well, a dessert for me, for example, because I've got a little bit of a sweet tooth. I don't have processed sugar. I would have a yogurt, which is natural, with natural bacteria in. Maybe some passion fruit, mango, some pomegranate, that sort of thing. And within the meal, I try to use as much pepper, turmeric, chili, even herbs and spices. And, you know, enjoy tea. But I do take the supplement as well because, like all of us, we're a bit busy at times. And I just get the reassurance by taking it with my breakfast and lunch.
we talked about the dessert and you said, I don't have sugar. So this is something I would like to discuss a little bit, because in your book you write that it's good to avoid sugar.
Mm.
And at least in Sweden, it has been a big debate where, I mean, sugar is, to me, it's pretty clear that sugar, we don't need refined sugar.
Mm.
But why would you say we should avoid sugar when it comes to cancer risks?
Yes, I mean, it's a good point. Sugar is not an essential nutrient. It didn't exist in the human diet till probably 100 years ago. And it always fascinates me that dietitians within hospital who I work with seem to think it's perfectly okay to advise sugar for patients. But the tide is turning. There is more and more evidence coming from large studies. I've just conducted one on a database with 155,000 people,
wow,
which were followed for 20 years. And we ask questions about their diet. You know, do you eat polyphenol-rich foods? Do you smoke? Do you exercise? Do you have processed sugar? And it was, you know, barn door that people who had sugar had an increased risk for cancer. There's various mechanisms for this. We know that people who eat processed sugar, not in fruit and vegetables, that's completely different, but processed sugar or refined carbohydrates have an increased risk of diabetes.
Mm.
Diabetes is strongly linked to an increased risk of cancer.
Mm.
And the mechanism behind processed sugar is, the list is as long as your arm, but the salient points are, first of all, they're absorbed very quickly. Your insulin levels go up, then drop quite quickly because the sugar then levels drop. You feel hungry again, so it actually encourages you to eat more. Mm. So not only is sugar, it's got a lot of calories, you're hungry an hour later and you eat again.
Mm.
If you start the day, for example, and I've not so, a couple of years ago I changed to making sure there's absolutely zero sugar for breakfast, just fruit and other things. You don't get hungry halfway through the morning. You can go all the way through to the, you know, 1-2 o'clock. So you've had a period of fasting effectively, comfortable, because you're not getting hungry. So you don't need it. Secondly, we know that sugar feeds the bad bacteria in the gut. There's two types of bacteria, good and bad. The good bacteria improve gut health, improve gut integrity, stop leaky gut syndrome, which allows toxins to enter your body, which increases inflammation. Sugar feeds the bad bacteria, which displaces the good bacteria, causes inflammation in the gut wall, causes the gut wall to get thin. We're more likely to get IBS, food intolerances. We absorb the toxins of food very quickly. That creates inflammation in your body. And it's thought to be one of the theories why people get type 1 diabetes, because these toxins swilling around your blood, the body's constantly trying to fight them and our immunity's raised, and it hits other things. It's hitting those toxins, but it's hitting our joints, hitting our brains, hitting our pancreas.
Mm.
So, you know, sugar is the evil of many diseases.
Mm.
We also know that it creates an inflammatory reaction, so that when it's absorbed, the body, for some reason, thinks it's had a big meal, and it, just through nature, it creates these inflammatory markers. And in the book, I've described the biochemical reasons behind that. Now, there's a quirk of nature that if you have inappropriate high inflammation, that drives tumor cells. It reduces DNA repair and it encourages tumor cells to grow faster and spread and form roots and form metastases. Mm. So, I mean, I can go on and on and on. And the evidence is becoming clearer. I think people who stand up and say sugar's not as bad as it is haven't read the data. It's coming through. Biochemically, it's obvious. And clinically, it's obvious.
Mm. I sat exactly here at this table with the Minister for Public Health in Sweden, and I interviewed her, and I asked if Sweden shouldn't put a tax on sugary drinks as you've done in Great Britain. And she actually didn't believe in that, even though we see now the effect in UK, also in Chile, what happens.
Mm.
Do you think that we should impose a tax on sugar to try to get people to avoid having as much as we have?
Yes, as long as that money is used to promote healthy foods, not just a tax so they can buy more missiles or something.
No.
I mean, I was in Lithuania recently with the Minister of Health to support him putting a sugar tax. He became very unpopular, I have to say. Mm. But come on a hot summer's day, you go into a shop and a fizzy, sugary drink is, you know, is half a euro. Mm. And a bottle of water is 2 euros.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
that's so crazy.
It should be the other way around.
Yeah.
And also it gives a signal to people that sugar is bad. I mean, you might laugh at an experiment we did in our cancer unit where grateful patients are always donating sweets and chocolates to the nurses. So the nurses' station is full of them. So I made myself very unpopular by banning sugar just in the 60, in our unit, which has 60 staff, for a period of 3 months. Mm. And we then measured weight and we measured happiness score and we measured absenteeism. All three improved when we replaced sugar. And we added nuts and fruit and veg instead so they could eat on something. The main reason was it wasn't in their field of vision. Mm. They could, if they're feeling hungry, they reach out to a nut or an apple or something rather than a biscuit or something. So that was a very small move, a very small change in behavior. It might actually have a very significant impact across the NHS, which has a problem with obesity and diabetes and absenteeism. But it also gave a signal to the patients when they came in. They thought, well, hang on, there's something wrong with this sugar. And then they think about their own diet. Mm. So, I strongly believe a tax is one way which will alert patients, the population of the harm of sugar. In monetary terms, it doesn't really make a lot of difference because it's a few euros, you know, on a shopping once a week. It doesn't really affect many people, but it's the signal it gives them that sugar is harmful.
Mm. I totally agree. I read in your book that there was a study made on people who had two soft drinks a week and how actually this increased the risk of getting sick. And I was amazed because I don't remember the percentage here now, but I recall it was quite high. Mm. Higher than I thought. And I think that average people today, it's quite common to have at least two soft drinks in a week.
Yes, these studies are cohort studies. So they're based on questionnaires. So it's very difficult to have the exact figure. And when it's published, you say two or three. But it's more harmful. And don't forget, you're doing this habit all your life from a child to adulthood of taking something which your body perceives as dangerous. I haven't mentioned cholesterol levels. Actually, sugar's more responsible for high cholesterol than fats. Mm. Yeah, the public health message is to reduce fats, not to reduce sugar. The last three large studies from the American, actually, all showed it was the sugar driving the cholesterol level. Mm. So, we eat a lot of it over a long period of time.
Mm.
I also think it's combining. We talked about combining before.
Mm.
And when you have the sugar, if you, for example, have had lunch and you've got, you know, nice healthy lunch, which you're promoting, and you fancy something a little bit sweet afterwards, well, your stomach's already digesting the food, adding a little bit of processed sugar. I'm not saying it's good, but the impact is quite small.
Mm.
But if you're halfway through the morning and feeling hungry, there's nothing much in your stomach, and then you have a fizzy drink or a cake, that sugar will have a much higher impact on the biochemistry of your body. So it's when you have the sugar.
So what would you say about artificial sweeteners? Many people say, well, I stopped sugar.
Hmm.
I only cook with agave syrup or, you know.
Yeah. Oh, as I say, we have many debates about, you know, what is harmful, what isn't harmful. Whole fruits do have sugar. It's about 10% as opposed to 100% in sugar itself. And don't forget, whole fruits have polyphenols, which reduce the transfer of sugar across the gut wall, reducing the glycemic index, and have their own benefits. So whole fruits is fine. Honey is still very, very high in fructose. again, if you're going to have it after the meal. People then talk about artificial sweeteners. And, you know, at first sight, you think, well, there was no real direct correlation with cancer with them. That was overstated as a risk. My initial thought was, yeah, well, that, you know, maybe if they can't stop sugar, that's better than sugar. Unfortunately, there's been a series of trials published last year, which shows that they damaged gut health. So they're not good for gut health. And we know that gut health is really important. So I'm afraid they're not a healthy alternative.
So I don't know what you do when you want to have something sweet, but to me it's very easy if you bake something or do something at home to sweet with just a sweet fruit or something.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, to be honest, that your taste buds change. It changes from salt. Many people have reduced salt, and after a while you don't notice it. In fact, you find food's quite offensive if you've had. The same thing applies to sugar. If you, as you say, use bananas or whole fruits, you like that, and suddenly you're offered a cake packed full of sugar. You don't like the taste.
No.
So it's that's why the government really needs to step in and say, look, cut sugar in everything and make it more expensive, and the population will get used to it. In fact, they will then not like sugar.
And I mean, at the same time they do that, why don't, since in Europe we have too little vegetables and fruit, so why don't take away the VAT on fresh fruit and vegetables, maybe to stimulate people to buy more of that?
It's very hard. I teach in Cambridge University in the public health department. It's very hard to change behaviour for a population. It's easier, actually, if someone's been diagnosed with cancer or another illness, because they have a thing called a teachable moment, and they're more likely to change. But there's a whole psychology between trying to change national behaviour. One element is price. As you say, healthy fruit should be cheaper than unhealthy foods. But it's, you know, education. It's been seen as macho. I remember when smoking used to be seen as macho, and I think that message is gone.
You mean also the image, to create image, good images, healthy as a good image, and non-healthy as a bad image.
Yeah, because, you know, even in films, in Hollywood, you see people eating burgers and smoking, even this day and age, and they're rather cool, you know, they don't care about things. And you see people who are who look after themselves healthy being seen as slightly wimpy and less cool. You know, that needs to be changed, because it is cool to be healthy. It's cool to be able to go for a run as long as you want, you know, and feel hit and not be in and out of hospital on a drip. You know, that's not cool.
No. But talking about that, we talked about car carcinogenics before, and I read in your book that pesticides could be carcinogenics. Would you recommend to try and have as much organic fruit and vegetables if possible?
We didn't talk about phytoestrogenic carcinogens. Or more accurately, they're called xenoestrogens earlier on. These are present in pesticides, herbicides, plastics. Now, there's a big move against plastics, which I completely support. It's far too many, and they leak chemicals which are estrogenic. So they're going to make men infertile, and women will get increased risk of breast and ovarian and uterine cancer. They'll reduce the libido of men. So, as a population, if you've got men with a low libido and a low sperm count, that'll be the end of mankind, won't it?
It will be a Handmaid's Tale, if you've seen that.
Yes, I'm sure there's lots of films based on that topic. I mean, but it's happening. You see crocodiles in the Amazon with small penises. You see wild animals becoming infertile. I mean, it is happening now. I mean, the amount. So anyway, that's on a population in pollution type basis, but on an individual, organic, yes, it will reduce your input of pesticides and herbicides. That's for sure. It's very hard to show on an individual basis whether that has an impact on health. In fact, most trials don't show that. We know you have left less levels in your bloodstream, but it would take a trial, you know, lasting 20 years with thousands of people to actually prove it. But on a common sense side of things, we're getting estrogenic pollutants in our shampoo, in our soap, in our drinking water, the air we breathe with pollution. So it sort of makes sense to try and limit it if you can. But I wouldn't be totally paranoid about having to have everything organic. The other thing to remember, of course, when you have organic, the farming is different. So the animals are looked after better. There's less pollutants going into the water system.
And the soil.
The soil, there's more hedgerows, there's using insects. Ethical perspective, I would completely support as much organic as possible. But, you know, you don't have to pick up an apple, you know, at arm's length with a caliper if it's not organic.
Have the apple than not having the apple.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
This is what we write in our book as well. But I prefer organics if I can find it, of course. So I have so many more questions, but I have two more questions that I need to ask you because I like wine and I like coffee.
Good.
So I read that it's preferable to choose red wine because it's less harmful.
There are some polyphenols in white wine, actually. We all talk about resveratrol, which is in red wine. And resveratrol is a very healthy polyphenol. We know that people who drink red wine in the sun have less sun damage, you know, because it's protecting the DNA.
Drink red wine in the sun.
Absolutely, yes. I presented a talk to the British Prostate Organization recently about lifestyle, and I said the three things which protect you from prostate cancer is sunbathing without burning, drinking red wine, and having more sex. So I said, you know, we're not being horrible to people here.
No.
obviously too much red wine. Alcohol is at the end of the day a carcinogen as well. But a good quality red wine with lots of resveratrols is actually probably promotes gut health slightly. And it has anti-inflammatory properties. But obviously, if you do too much, you're going to get, it's going to go the other way.
But that's with everything. I mean, talking about having a lot of fruit and vegetables, you also stress in your book, as we always say, that a variety is always important. Mm. Also, as you said, the polyphenols come from different families.
Yeah.
And they help each other and become stronger together.
Yeah, I mean, chocolate has lots of polyphenols in. The trouble is with dark chocolate might have sugar. So if you do have chocolate, get the 100% sugar free. And you can always mix it with fruit to make it. It does have theolene in, which can give some people a headache. It's a stimulant. It's a bit like caffeine. So that's the problem with dark chocolate. Coffee, people say, I smoke, but I don't drink coffee. Well, I'm afraid nearly all the studies, these big population studies, when they ask if you take coffee, it shows a slight reduction in bowel cancer risk, for example, and probably a reduction in heart disease because it's a vasodilator. So it's not particularly harmful. It's not harmful at all. It's probably slightly beneficial, especially if it's a good coffee made from coffee beans. Tea is likewise healthy. One thing what we did, we are going to publish this year, so I'm not sure if I should tell you, but I think I will anyway. If you add sugar to your tea and coffee, you mitigate the benefits, which is not a surprise. So when we asked the question, do you drink tea or coffee? If the answer was yes, we looked to see if they subsequently had cancer. It was less. We then said, do you have tea and coffee, but add sugar to it? They had no benefit. So if you put sugar in your coffee, I'm afraid it's not healthy.
Oh, and this is a study we will be able to read about later this year.
Yes, it's coming out later in the year.
Oh, right. This is a preview. Okay, so I'm so grateful that you came, and I could actually recommend everyone to read your book because everyone I know wants to stay as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And I guess these advices are not only for cancer, but for many lifestyle-related diseases.
Yes, I mean, cancer is a chronic degenerative disease. So it's in the same ballpark as diabetes, joint pains, dementia. So the advice is pretty much the same. It's about getting your body to help yourself. And what we try to do in the book is to have as much evidence base as possible so we can dispel the myths which are being exposed to people all the time through an overzealous journalist, perhaps.
So thank you so much, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you.
You have listened to The Food Pharmacy Show with Lina Närtby and Mia Klase, joined by special guest Professor Robert Thomas. Links to the studies he mentioned in the interview can be found on keephealthy.com. The podcast is edited by me, Sebastian Ring, and I've also composed all the music. For more Food Pharmacy content, visit foodpharmacyco.com and follow us on Instagram, food_pharmacy.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.